Okay, welcome everyone to this May 27th, 2020, 9/11 and other deep state crimes teleconference. Craig, do you want to take the role?
Sure. I will read the names here that I have in front of me. Sheila Casey, Barry Zwicker, Bonnie Faulkner, Sherry Jacobs, Cheryl Curtis, Craig McKee, Dan Hennen, Fern Tishman, Jessica Coco, John O'Malley, Lynn Cornelison, Marie Spike, Peter Ketchum, Richard Krushnick, Tom Wilcutt, and Xander Arena. Did I get everybody?
Yep, not me. Greg Boyd.
Oh, Greg Boyd. Now, that's funny because you're not showing up here at all. Okay, we'll make a note to add you on there. Anybody else?
Are you coming in through Skype? I'm just wondering.
I'm calling on a cell phone.
Oh, okay. All right.
Oh.
I don't know why that's not showing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Greg, aren't you the 240 area code?
240-855-9809.
Oh, yeah. Are you with Dan Hennen? Because we have that under Dan Hennen.
Oh, I thought Dan told me that was his number earlier. Okay.
No,
I wrote that
down. I don't
know
him.
Okay.
All right. So can you change that, Craig?
Yeah, I can, but we also have Dan on here.
But Dan, are you coming in on Skype?
Oh, we have a new number that just showed up, 301 area code.
That's
I don't
me,
think Skype
Marina
will let
Kinder.
You call in.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, who's that?
My name is Candace Clough. I am, Sheila told me about the call.
Okay.
9/11 in D.C.
Welcome.
Okay. Welcome. What is your last name, Candace?
Clough, C-L-O-U-G-H.
Okay, great.
Hi, Candace.
Hi, Sheila. How are you?
I'm good.
Okay, so I think we have everybody then?
Yes.
Craig,
yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Yeah. Great. So, okay, let's get started then. So as you all know, we're without a secretary, so we're behind on our minutes from last month, and we're going to get those out hopefully in the next week, and then they'll be presented for approval on the June teleconference call. It's June 24th. And if anyone would like to volunteer to help us even for 1 month be the secretary, we would love that. So just let us know, please. Okay. And then... there is one typo on the agenda, and our second speaker, Tom Wilcutt, in some places his name is spelled with an H at the beginning, like Hillcutts, but it is actually with W. Wilcutt is the correct spelling on that. So anyway, are there any objections to the agenda with that typo correction included for tonight as written and distributed? Any objections to the agenda?
No.
Hey, hearing none, they're accepted? Okay.
Yes.
As written, and okay, let's move on then. It's with really great sadness that that we welcome to our first speaker to discuss the loss of our dear colleague, James Hufford. Craig, do you want to introduce Lynn?
Yeah. It won't be a long introduction because I'm just meeting Lynn myself, but... Lynn worked with James with the Iowa 9/11 Truth Group, and they worked together to organize the meetings and set them up for, I think Lynn told me, 14 years. So it's a great loss for all of us, but it's a great loss for him as well. So I asked him to come on the call, and because he wanted to join, and so I asked him to come on and talk about James and sort of talk about the loss. Lynn, are you... Cheryl, we should also do the lecture mode thing.
Yes, I'm.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. So we'll hand it over. We have to unmute Lynn. And where is he? Okay, I got him. Lynn, are you there?
I sure am.
Okay, great. So I'm going to pass it over to you, and you can say anything you'd like to tell us about James.
Okay, I'll just start with, take off where you left off, that I knew him in 2006 when I discovered a little ad in the newspaper about a group meeting on 9/11, and I just discovered and woke up to Building 7 in January of 2005. So off I went to Adel, Iowa. I'm in southwest Iowa. I'm an hour from, basically it's Des Moines. It's 20 minutes west of Des Moines where James was at. He just lives south of the library, about five blocks. And so I started going, and I was just as, I just went to practically every meeting. And we became friends, and it just took off from there. And eventually there was another guy that was actually doing a lot of DVDs, and Dave Scar. And then he died a number of years ago. Actually, he quit coming to the meetings before that, and I just kind of filled those shoes. It wasn't by any vote or anything like that. It's just I just knew I was a person. And so anyway, yeah, I started picking James up then at his house because he didn't drive. And so we would go down to the meeting about 6:30 and get set up with the coffee and whatnot and get ready for the people to come, and we would get the, they got a very nice meeting room there, a 6x8 projector in a room, and they were a great library. And so there we would meet, and we went down every rabbit hole there was to go down to, just collecting information year after year, and speakers or Skype or in person we would have people. And well, David Ray Griffin first came there, and we set him up at Drake University. And I remember James introducing him, and it filled the Bulldog Arena. And then Richard came, and he came down to our little group after the Ames Auditorium, and James had him there. And James would always get up and talk, and we had a good time. He was very interested all the time. He was... his passion was always committed, and I think you probably know that from him being on the teleconferences. But we used to have a yearly varsity theater by Drake University. We'd show a presentation. We would pay about $350 among us to get the theater going, but they closed here, and they got bought out by somebody a couple of years ago, I believe, and we stopped that until further notice. But anyway, coming up to what lately, I just hadn't heard from him email-wise, and neither had another woman. And we kind of got concerned. She said, have you heard from James? And I said, well, no, I was thinking about that too. So I called his place and couldn't get nothing but his answer machine, and couldn't get any response email-wise. And so I called the sheriff up there, and he went down and couldn't get in and talk to the neighbors, and they said he was, you know, pretty much kept to himself. So they were thinking about a forced entry, and they didn't, and we were worried he was in there, you know, dead. And but he got a hold and called me back and said, well, they located him. He'd got a hold of the hospital there, and James's doctor said that that he didn't feel like he was getting the results he wanted, and he checked himself into Mercy One West out of Des Moines. And so I called up there and got the floor nurse and got him right directly on the phone. And so there he was. And I called him back again. We talked and talked the next day, and I asked him what the prognosis was. And he said outright, he said, I got 3 months to live. And I'm going, wow. He did sound a lot different on the second phone call, like he had this hiccup that was every 10 seconds. It didn't sound right. And... so anyway, but he told me he said he got bored, so he got up one night and wrote 4 pages of notes, or like he was writing another book or something. And so he was pretty active, and he was looking forward to going home. He was going to give me the password to the 9/11 Truth site, and he said, well, he's looking forward to getting into it again, and he was going to go home and have hospice home care. So anyway... so that Friday when he was, I knew he was saying he was going to be out of there by Friday. Well, I gave him time because he said he was talking to a lot of other people on the phone. So Monday I called him in the morning and I couldn't get through. The lines were jammed. And I finally did get through. I called his sister, he told me about, that lived north of Adel. And I called the cell phone. They own a little winery out of a barn there, real nice renovated place. And anyway, her husband was at the grocery store, and he had her cell phone, and he answered, and he said, "Oh, I hate to tell you," and I knew what was coming because, you know, James was going downhill, but I really wasn't quite expecting it right then. So, that pretty much how it all came down. And then I called the sister, and, you know, James wanted me, he told me, he said, "I want you to have," he's got 20,000 books. Oh, my. He said, "I want you to have first crack at my books." And I felt a little odd about that, like, you know, "Oh, yeah, let me in his books," you know. But anyway, I knew what he meant. So I was going to go up there, but, of course, I didn't make it up there because things happened quick. And then I found out that he went to Johnston Hospice just north of Des Moines. So there was like, well, and then there was confusion over, he thought he was going home, and he told me that. And hospice home care, I guess they do that. I've known hospice before. My mom died at about 100 a couple years ago. And he went to Johnston, and that's where he died. So I don't know what, because somebody, I think it was his sister, said, well, that isn't what we knew. But anyway, that's kind of the story. I mean, James was, like I said, he was committed to the soles of his feet, as I've heard said. He was fun all the time. I mean, he was always had something on his mind to talk about.
So
I feel like somebody's really missing from, it's just odd not having him around.
Yeah, thank you, Lynn, for sharing that. I also really miss him, and it was kind of a shock to hear that he was gone. So I thought he contributed a lot to this call also. I'm going to put this in Q&A.
Hi, this is Sheila Casey. I was wondering, I know that James did a lot of writing, and I was wondering if someone could put in the notes the URL for where his writings are stored. Hello, can anybody hear me?
I can.
Yeah, Sheila, it's Craig. I just was trying to get myself unmuted there. I don't know. I know he has a website called 911grassroots.org. I don't know that that's where all his, I mean, he's got books, obviously, that were published.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So Lynn would know the answer better than me. Okay.
He did Colonel Crystal's, Colonel Crystal and the Parallel Universe was his last book. And,
okay.
I've got a copy of that. I don't know where you can get it, and they haven't called me back yet to even let me go up there and see what's what. And, you know, people are a little odd, even family members. I mean, his sister told me they weren't really close. They only talked about maybe twice a year, and it was just cordial, and that was it. I kind of got the feeling that they were lived in completely different worlds, and I get that. I'm got a brother and sister, you know, thought I was, you know, half crazy, you know, back when the 9/11 first started and I was involved in it. And, you know, I just, my mom understood it and got it, but my brother and sister didn't. They were older than me, so. But I'll mention something else that I thought was very interesting with James. The last couple meetings, we talked about other things. We decided, okay, we'll just, you know, meeting attendance was down and had been, you know, for a number of years. People kind of drifted away. But he got to talking about personal experiences, and he told me that his cat that died a couple of years ago was always in bed with him down by his feet. I mean, he could say he could feel it physically at night. And then he got to, and then the same thing, he would be looking at his doorway and he would see people running by his doorway. And I said, "You mean just like you could see?" "Yes." And that was not a one-time occurrence. And I instantly thought Colonel Crystal and Parallel Universe was quite fitting to what he was experiencing.
And what was that website again, Craig?
It's 911grassroots.org.
911grassroots.org. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
He said the website didn't work right, but I said, well, that was a name problem. But
okay, I know he did a lot of publishing.
Yeah, I'll ask them and get back with you on what's going to happen with his books, because the picture of the books with him sitting at the little table with them all, that was upstairs at the Adel Library. I don't know if anybody's seen that. I posted it on my Facebook page.
Yeah, I think that, yeah.
Okay, we have an Xander. Xander, you're next. Go ahead.
Hey, Lynn, I just wanted to thank you for coming on the call and sharing that bit of back history about James. I really valued his input on our call. And so, anyways, thank you. And, yeah, that's really all I got, other than just encouraging you to do what you can, you know, to kind of preserve his legacy, his efforts, his research, his work, and to invite you to come back to the call more often.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you know before.
I had asked them if I could have his computer tower, and they said it was probably password locked, and I said, that's okay, I can just take the hard drive out, and because I wanted whatever I could out of there. I didn't want it to go to waste. But like I said, they haven't called me, and I feel kind of strange calling them. You know, I don't want to go putting any kind of feeling like I'm under some kind of pressure to give it to me. I just said that's what James had kind of indicated to me, and I wouldn't think they would. But I don't know if they know how important it was what he was doing. I don't even know for sure if they knew exactly what he did. I mean, I told them, and but they didn't like, oh, wow, we knew it.
Thanks for coming on the call, man. Really appreciate it.
Okay.
Yeah, and Lynn, do you know the exact date of James' passing away?
May 18th in the morning.
May 18th, okay. Thanks. Yeah, and thanks again for coming on the call and sharing that with us. And you're welcome to stay on, I hope you will, for the rest of the call. But if you have other things to do, we understand. But really appreciate your sharing that about our dear friend James.
Nope, I'm here.
Okay, great. Okay. All right. So,
Lynn is going to be joining us on a regular basis. So.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
So we welcome him and Candace both to the group.
Okay. Let's...
Oh, never mind.
Okay, so let's see. All right, so we're back in lecture mode, and I'm just going to unmute. Xander's already unmuted. Okay, so we're back in lecture mode, and we're going to our second speaker now, and which is going to be our colleague here, Xander Arena, who most of you know. So I'm just going to give a really brief introduction of him, since you all know him. He's a radiology worker specializing in nuclear medicine, and is the leader of the AE 911 Truth's verification team, and he's here to talk to us today about the coronavirus in several different angles. So, Xander, welcome and thank you, and take it away. Xander?
You sure he's unmuted?
He's unmuted, according to what it says here.
Huh.
Xander? Well, let me try muting him and unmuting him again and just see if that does anything.
He might just have stepped away from the phone for a moment.
No, I just heard it say unmuted. So, can you hear me?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, great. If for some reason my audio is bad, please feel free to interrupt me, okay?
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
So everybody, I just wanted to let you know a little bit about my experience with COVID-19. in a clinical setting, working at the hospital, I have seen the virus in action. I know there's been discussion as to whether how real it is and all that sort of stuff, and it is in fact a nasty bug. At least two of the patients that I worked with have died from the disease pretty quickly after coming down with it. So that was, you know, a bit unsettling to see it grab hold of somebody like that. And I saw a lot of the firsthand. I saw a lot of the things that you've probably read about, bizarre appearances in the lungs, ground glass opacities, things like that. So real virus. In the clinical setting, I've done what I can to protect myself with N95 mask and goggles and things like that. And so far, I haven't gotten it, or at least I've had two negative tests and a negative antibody test. So I don't think I've caught this thing. I work in Phoenix, and we haven't had a whole lot of cases here. So it was pretty mellow. Our hospital and many of the other hospitals in Maricopa County where I live prepared for the worst. Yeah, I think you've probably heard this, but, you know, all of the other procedures that weren't vital or life-saving necessities were canceled in the spring. A lot of staff were sent home. The hospitals functioned as a ghost ship, basically, anticipating a wave of sick people that really here, at least, didn't really materialize. You know, we did have cases, but it wasn't that bad. So, the next little thing that I want to talk about is the origin of this particular virus, what it is, where it came from. And though I don't claim to know with certainty what, where, and how, I'm pretty confident that this thing was, in fact, engineered in a laboratory, that it was not a zoonotic transfer from a bat or a pangolin or a bat and a pangolin having a party or anything like that. And so I'll just talk a little bit about why I think that. So one of the things that I do here in Arizona, I help with radiological responses for our nuclear generating station, Palo Verde, as a volunteer disaster relief person because of my training in nuclear medicine. So I understand radioisotopes very well. And so that puts me in contact sometimes with state-level agencies, our equivalent of the Health and Human Services and our Department of Emergency Management. And so I'd gotten wind of this drill called Crimson Contagion before I think a lot of others had, because it had concerned state-level people here. You know, I think enough Americans have kind of come to associate drills and things going live and other things. I mean, people even in the government are probably concerned when a drill gets run, you know. And anyways, that was the case here, is that there were state-level folks who really felt the timing of Crimson Contagion was odd with this new emerging Wuhan thing. And so I started focusing, and I caught the Indian researcher's work, which claimed HIV, you know, inserts into the virus early on, and started paying attention to that and contacted them directly to ask them more about their work. The reply that I received from the group in India basically said that they had shifted their focus. They felt that in this time of extreme pandemic and death, it was better to focus on cures and saving lives than pointing blame. So they had shifted their research towards cures and antibodies and things like that, and basically said there's nothing more that we have to say on this topic. But interestingly, I had asked them some questions about, so let me back up just a little bit. The Indians published a paper claiming HIV. There were a few rebuttal papers here in the West saying, you know, that's absurd. This stuff came from, you know, from an animal, and here are these other instances where we have similar inserts. And I always try to look at both sides. So I read their work, and there was one that I found a little interesting, and this is another virus called RATG13. It's this RATG13. Which does have a lot, share a lot of similarity with SARS-2. And I had contacted those researchers that had written that paper in particular. They were out of University of Michigan and had some questions for them. And so I've been asking these scientists back and forth what their thoughts are and why they think this, that, and the other thing. Well, when I confronted the Indian group with this rebuttal paper, I asked them about rat G13, and I said, is it possible that rat G13 was also engineered and was maybe introduced into an animal vector essentially as cover for this new SARS? And though they weren't willing to really weigh in on that, he did say, the guy I was talking to said, this link, and if you read halfway through the abstract, this will answer all your questions. And he pointed me to research from 2008 in which a group of scientists, I guess it doesn't really matter where, but it was in fact in China. And if I remember correctly, it was actually at the Wuhan Virology Institute. But they had taken the original SARS spike and had attached it to a bat-like coronavirus in a lab, and were working with that pseudovirus as to understand its ability to infect human cells. So, bottom line, this is actually very common research to create pseudoviruses, to take parts of one virus and combine it with another. Sometimes what they'll do is they'll take a virus and they will attach it to a different kind of virus, like a lentivirus, which is like an HIV analog, and they will use that to infect cells in a lab. But if that virus were to actually get in a human, it wouldn't behave like the original lentivirus, nor would it behave like the spike of the originating virus. So basically it would be relatively safe if it, worst case scenario, did get into somebody. And so they'll do these pseudoviruses so that they can work with biosafety level 4 viruses in biosafety level 3 environments. And they can still learn a lot about functionality because they can look at, say, just the spike portion of a very deadly contagion while it's attached to the body of a virus, which is less virulent. So it's very common, and looking at all this, the other thing I found that was pretty neat, and I'm going to put links to these articles, we're going to send them out in the minutes for this particular call, and I will probably email them to the group as well, but I found a peer-reviewed work from 2006 in which a group of scientists had deliberately inserted what's called a furin cleavage site into the original SARS-1 spike protein. So they took the original SARS and they wanted to enhance it, and so they inserted a furin cleavage site right about halfway down the spike protein, which is, and it did in fact aid this particular virus or spike functionality. So what I'm getting at is when you hear these rebuttal works from, I think we have one from Nature Medicine, and I forget the other one, but when these papers are coming out saying that it would be impossible for a laboratory to create SARS-2, they're just lying to all of us. And that's really what I have to say. And their lies are so disingenuous that, to me, that really, it calls them out. It reminds me of like when Condoleezza Rice would say, nobody envisioned airplanes being used as weapons, despite there being tons of instances of exactly that. Or when they would say, buildings don't get demolished from the top down, so therefore it couldn't be a controlled demolition. So you'll hear people say, we've never seen a virus like this before, so therefore it couldn't have been engineered, which, to me, is like crazy talk. It's that they're speaking in backwards land. It's, of course it could have been engineered to look different than something we've seen before. I've got some examples that might be helpful for people to look at, some peer-reviewed work that they can look and see that, in fact, these sorts of manipulations have been going on for a long time. And I guess my takeaway from this is that this particular virus, I believe, was in fact crafted. And I think it was made to do exactly what it's doing. which is to be a very problematic spreader. You know, it's R-naught has been estimated by Los Alamos Labs to be as high as 6, which means it's incredibly infectious. It's really, really good at getting into the human body and then getting into others. It survives relatively well in the environment. I mean, it's like the perfect storm to get this thing to go pass around to everybody. And it is problematic enough that people care. You know, I don't think anybody wants to catch it. Nobody wants to die from some nasty bug. And it is causing complications in people. But at the same time, it's not horrible in the sense that, you know, it's not a hemorrhagic fever. It's primarily affecting our extreme elderly or infirm. And so, I mean, it's almost, you know, I think about like when they blew up the towers, you know, they weren't really trying to wreak total havoc. You know, they brought the towers down neatly into their footprints and minimized damage outside because they had a goal, and the goal was a little bit of terror, but not total destruction. And I think that's what I don't know who the they is. We'll talk about that in a second. But I think that whoever it was up to this thing, you know, that's basically what they had in mind. So moving on to the day, I just kind of want to point folks in a direction that I've been leaning, and I don't know that this is accurate, but it resonates with me, and that's the work that Whitney Webb has been doing. She started writing on this a series called Engineering Contagion over at Mint Press News. I think now she's writing with Last American Vagabond, but you know, whoever she's writing for, she's an exceptionally competent researcher, and she's done some really great work on this topic. And one of the things she kind of dialed in on was our current Health and Human Services director, Kedlick, had ties to the Amerithrax back in 2001. And Dark Winter is what they called it, an operation called Dark Winter in the summer of 2001. And I think you're probably, a few of you have heard talk about a coming Dark Winter and some other things. So there's just a lot of corollaries with these biodefense folks from 2001, and they're all kind of rearing their head now. And some of them are in key positions right now. And I would encourage all of you to read Whitney's work on that. We've all, I think, heard of the Crimson Contagion stuff. I mentioned that earlier, which was a multi-state drill simulating a pandemic coronavirus or flu-like virus. They had Event 201, which was a Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation-sponsored deal, which specifically dealt with coronavirus. And, you know, the Gates have been, they're all over this vaccine train. And one of the things that Whitney spoke about or wrote about was a connection between Gates and Jeffrey Epstein back in at least 2001. And then in her recent interview with Maria Farmer discusses the fact that Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell knew Epstein as early as the mid-90s. So there's an old connection between those folks, and we know that Epstein was working at the behest of a foreign power to subvert the American government and compromise our politicians and all the rest of it. And so, you know, I'm not saying that that's what Gates has done or is doing, but we do know that Gates is a eugenicist of sorts. He's talked about trying to cull global population, and that James Corbett did a really nice series. If you guys haven't seen that, talking about Gates. So I'd also encourage you to look up Corbett's stuff on Gates. And I guess I just want to express some concerns that I'm having with a potential vaccine for this coronavirus, because they're steering us in the direction of a vaccine called messenger RNA. And that is a different approach to vaccinating people. It may, in fact, be a very good approach, but it also is a little scary to me. And the reason is that rather than give the person a weakened virus of some sort, which would confer an immunity, messenger RNA, that approach it basically inserts genetic code into our own genome and induces our cells to create the antibodies themselves. So it skips the normal process and basically hardwires our cells to produce antibodies to a particular substance. the other thing, though, is that messenger RNA could induce our cells to do anything that they're instructed to do. So you could have a messenger RNA produce certain hormones or produce proteins that could be damaging to tissue or damaging to an organism. You could potentially have messenger RNA induce cancers. I mean, you could have messenger RNA really just do whatever, you know, you asked it to do. And the fact that some of these folks who, you know, were likely behind Amerithrax and whatnot are now standing at the helm with this new potential mandated vaccine and all the rest of it, it has me on edge. It has me nervous. I think back to the Khmer Rouge, you know, when you know, however many million people, they killed their intellectuals, they killed their what they deemed dissidents, but, you know, they did that with guns and rifles and fire. And, you know, if the vaccine shows up on my doorstep and it's name on it, I'm going to be really, really concerned. So I don't know what we can do as a people to ensure that whatever vaccines come out are safe. But I think a starting place would to be to have them be open source, if possible. You know, if we could have, you know, something where people could review the code that's being given. I don't think that vaccines should be tailored to each of us. They should probably, you know, if I take Sheila's vaccine or Craig's or my neighbor's, it should all be the same. That might be a way to help ensure safety and not targeted killing. And, you know, this might seem a little bit conspiratorial and crazy, but it's just a legitimate concern that I have. I see it as a plausible way for the deep state to get rid of a whole lot of problems. Because they could do it surreptitiously, you could have code inserted that would basically create disease in people that would look natural. It would just look like I got a cancer, whatever, my hypertension, thing, you know, I'm dead. And it's a concern I have. So those are the three things that I wanted to bring to the call. Was one, to let folks know that the virus, you know, it's not a hoax. It's a real thing. I've seen it. I definitely think it was engineered. And I have some concerns about the direction that this is all going. And I will, in an email to the group, I'll send some links to Whitney Webb's work, Corbett's work, the peer-reviewed articles that I spoke about. And that's it. I'm going to turn over the call to any questions.
Okay. Thank you so much, Sandra. Let me just put it in Q&A mode, and you might be muted for a moment. So just hang on with that, okay? Okay. So, Xander, while people are getting in line to ask you some questions, I just want to ask you that, and thank you for sharing your experience in the hospital, because I live in Connecticut, and I know we don't have many cases around where I live, so I wasn't sure if this was, like, real or not, but hearing you was helpful in that. And did the two people who died in your hospital that you encountered, were they elderly, or did they have other illnesses? Maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah. Well, they were both in their 70s, early 70s. One was 71, one was 72. They had what we call comorbidities. They had some issues, but nothing that would have killed them, you know, in that year or likely. You know, a person might have diabetes or might have hypertension or things like that. But wouldn't just anticipate that they would just die the next day. Based on that. Yeah, so I would definitely say it seemed like an accelerated death due to COVID. I think that they were legitimate cases. I saw one instance, and it's probably an outlier. I think more often than not, people are being called COVID when they may be dying of something else. But I did see a case where a guy pretty clearly had COVID, based on his imaging anyway, his radiological reports, and they did not call him that. They never tested him. And he died pretty quickly. On a ventilator even, and they just had never tested him, so they didn't deem him a positive COVID death. So I've seen it go both directions. I don't have a whole lot of data to work with because I'm kind of in the periphery. You know, being in radiology, I'm seeing scans and tests done on folks. I'm not directly involved in everybody's care. So,
Uh-huh. Yeah, I get it. Yeah. Okay, thanks. And so let's go to our first person to ask you a question. That's Barry Zwicker. Barry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, thanks. By the way, just a technical thing, Xander. I myself here in Toronto was having quite a lot of trouble understanding all you said. I think I lost about 50% of it. So if indeed you could do a simple thing like speak more closely into your phone or something, that would be welcome. My question has to do with artificially induced deaths. Now, I can't really quote carefully, but I know that in my old memory banks, there have been various cases where someone has suffered a suspicious death. Somebody typically who's left of center, shall we say, and then maybe has a heart attack when there were no signs, as far as we were told that they were in danger of that. We did have a Canadian political leader here in Canada, Jack Layton, was his name, and he started to do tremendously well in the polls in a federal election, and in fact, he became the leader of the opposition for the New Democratic Party, and suddenly, I would just say suddenly, he gets cancer, and it just seemed kind of convenient. But I know that I'm not speaking in any kind of scientific terms, but I wonder if you have any background to offer about, for instance, the CIA's previous abilities to interfere and have a person succumb when it looks like a natural thing.
Yeah, Barry, hey, thanks for the question. I think it's absolutely a real thing. I mean, they had, you know, we had public hearings on the heart attack gun. There's probably a ton of ways to take somebody out. What might be happening is that, you know, you have enough people who are quote-unquote awake or, you know, are on to 9/11 or on to these other things, the Epstein stuff and what have you, and it may just be a numbers game. And this is, it's conjecture, you know, this is a God forbid, right? Because it could all be just that, you know, all they want to do is get some forced vaccinations and put some RFIDs in us, you know, and have better tracking and control in that manner. The possibilities are there. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a history of it. And in fact, thinking back to the Khmer Rouge, I mean, I think the Central Intelligence Agency directly supported and helped them. I think that was a Kissinger, you know, essentially endorsed that. While we would publicly say it was horrible, I believe there were UN votes and other things that clearly showed we didn't truly feel that way, or at least that we supported it. So I think there's a history for targeted killing.
Thanks, yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Barry, for the question. Next, we have Jessica Coco. Jessica, go ahead.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
I can. Hi, Jessica.
Hello, hi. Okay, I have two questions to ask. Maybe three. One of them is that it's reported that out of the COVID deaths, that they all had been vaccinated. And two, that they were in areas that had 5G. So that's one question. Is this COVID in one of the flu vaccines, for example? I do know that in Italy they gave the double pneumonia meningitis and 4-in-1 flu shot that I'm aware of. Second, now there's some talk that it might be actually a bacterium. I've read instead of a virus. And what else do I want to ask, or is that really it? I think that's it at this point, yes.
Okay. Yeah, happy to answer those questions. So the first question, I don't think that COVID is related to 5G, that the disease of COVID-19, the coronavirus disease, in any way. You know, I mean, 5G might be an environmental factor, but it's not pervasive. It's not. I just know. I don't see the mechanism for it. I've seen COVID without any 5G in place. So, you know, are they at the same time rolling out 5G in America? Absolutely. You know, yeah, they're doing it. I don't think the two are connected.
Other than maybe, you know, it was a convenient time to push a lot of 5G because everybody's been on quarantine and lockdown, you know, but I don't think that the disease process is augmented or changed or affected in any way by electromagnetic radiation is what I'm getting at. I think this virus is perfectly well equipped to do damage all on its own. It's been designed as such. It's very effective at getting into our ACE2 receptors, and it also has the ability to interfere with our T cells. So it's got a lot of features to it. I mean, this thing is really supercharged. To use a word that I got from a guy that you may have heard of named Paul Cottrell, but he's right. This thing is supercharged. It's got a lot of stuff going on. So that's one thing. That's my opinion. The other question you asked about the vaccines, I don't think that SARS-2 was given to us in vaccines, in flu vaccines. I don't have a reason to think that. I don't think that the flu vaccine necessarily augmented this, and I don't have any background data to know how many of the deaths had vaccines versus didn't. So I just don't know. I'll shy away from that one. But I'm open to the idea that if they wanted this thing to get spread around to do lockdowns and different control things, you know, they might have seeded the country. And I don't know if it was done via products or, you know, maybe it was done in vaccines. I just don't know. Maybe it was just done with carriers. Maybe it wasn't done at all and it just spread because it does spread very quickly. But I'm open to the idea that it could have been seeded. I think there were reports out of Iran that there were hats that were delivered that had cellophane packages inside of them that dissolved under with sweat, and inside of the packages, the Iranians claimed to have found SARS-2. So, it's possible. And then your third question,
a bacterium. Is it a bacterium?
Oh, yeah.
Some reports of that.
Right, so this has to do with this idea of, I think it's called like lysosomes, that basically, I'm not buying it. I mean, I've heard that there's one doctor in particular who really, you know, has gone after this angle. In my mind, he reminds me of what we call in the truth movement, like a no-planer. It seems like a really far stretch, you know, to think that somehow humanity has mistaken viruses for decades across the continent, you know, all the planet. I mean, it's like flat Earth in a sense. It's maybe even done on purpose to get folks confused, because it is a virus. You can see it as a virus. We can sequence it. We can get the RNA. I mean, the RNA is a code, and it is a code for a beta coronavirus. I mean, these things are well classified, well understood. I don't think that this disease is caused by bacteria. But if somebody's immune system is shot, they can succumb to other things. I mean, we have bacteria all around us and in us and whatnot. And it is causing some complications with the immune system. So, you know, there might be coincidental stuff. But, no, I don't think that COVID is bacteria. Good question. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Jessica. Next we have Richard Krushnick. Richard, go ahead.
The Richard Krushnick up here in Boston. I wanted to mention this Newsweek article of 2 weeks ago, which seems to be well documented, that Fauci's organization, which is the government organization responsible for defending us from things like this, gave two grants to the Wuhan lab, one in 2014, one in 2019. They both grants were explicitly through gain of function methodology to mutate bat viruses into a new coronavirus capable of jumping to humans and causing some pandemic. Now, presumably, the purpose of this was to be able to develop a vaccine against such a virus. That's also very normal. Just like a bioweapon, you can't create an antidote to a pandemic unless you have the pandemic. Just like in our lab right here in Boston, our level 4 lab, which has to do whatever the Pentagon tells it to do for 20 years based on its funding. It supposedly is a lab that's supposed to develop antidotes to bioweapons. That, by definition, means it's a bioweapons lab because you have to create the agent before you can create the antidote. Anyway, I think that certainly increases the likelihood that it was something that escaped from the Wuhan lab, whether it was developed to be deliberately deployed or whether it's something that was developed with better motivations and just escaped from the lab. I think the fact that the U.S. government explicitly funded an effort to develop such a new coronavirus certainly increases the likelihood that it was created in the Wuhan lab. And secondarily, the point about ways of killing people without it being traceable, it's, I think, very well accepted, certainly in the alternative literature, that the U.S., that the CIA successfully developed very rapidly expanding cancers initially in their effort to induce a cancer into Fidel Castro. But at any rate, it's quite well documented in various ways that these developments happened way back in 1961, 1962,
1963.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, thanks. The only thing I just want to add there is, you know, the proximity of the Wuhan lab and this maybe release, you know, just because, you know, there's a gun in my car doesn't mean I used it to kill somebody, right? Somebody could have planted the weapon, that kind of thing. And similarly with these BSL-4 labs, I mean, it's definitely noteworthy. I mean, I'm paying as much of attention to it as anybody. But I, you know, I don't know that China, that it necessarily came from this lab. It could have come from anywhere else. Also, Wuhan is a huge area. The lab, I think, was, you know, 20-something miles away from the first initial outbreaks. And you could see this thing anywhere. So, yeah. But I'm tracking with you, man. I agree.
But don't you think it's significant? I mean, that the U.S. funded this?
Absolutely. Yeah, Fauci's involvement with this, 100% significant. I mean, it's scary significant, especially for them to then come out and pretend like these things couldn't be. I mean, this is where they're really, this is the tell. The fact that they're not willing to just simply say, you know, yeah, this could have been engineered, but we think it came from a bat because of such and such. But they're just outright saying, oh, no, absolutely, definitely a zoonotic transfer. They're lying. And, you know, that reveals their guilt to me. And it's coming from NSAID. It's coming from, you know, Fauci, from you know, a lot of, you know, some of the journals that are pushing this stuff and some of the universities. You know, I don't know if the universities are beholden to funding or if the journals are compromised. We've seen journals compromised in 9/11 Truth. I mean, look at the American Society of Civil Engineers and what they've managed to suppress. You know, if you have some folks who are kind of compromised at the top, I mean, we may have this going on in some of our medical journals. I don't know, but yeah, it's ludicrous that nobody is willing to just say that it could, and is in fact most likely was crafted. You know, that's the only thing. I didn't say this in the initial deal. If you don't mind, I'll just add the changes or the features that are in SARS-2 are so like precisely tailored to be a problem, and are so, they really got a lot out of adding PRAA, these four amino acids. I mean, these things, they added a furin cleavage site. There's some new research that says that the motif or the shape of the spike in that area, now that this PRAA is in there, is actually emulating a super antigen similar to the shapes found in like cobra venom and rabies. I mean, it's things that the body has already kind of keyed to respond to, and that's one of the reasons it might be having an effect on our T cells. So anyways, I just think that, and the similarity between SARS-2 and any other known virus is only like 96%, which is actually a pretty significant difference. I mean, we and chimpanzees are 96% similar, right? There's a lot of differences between us and a chimp.
Can I point out one more thing here? That I find it very interesting that it's been publicly released that the U.S. funded this gain-of-function work in the lab to create a coronavirus that can jump to humans. And at the same time that this comes out, the Trump administration ramps up its stuff about, we're going to get to the bottom of this. We think this came from China, that they developed this. You know, we're going to get to the bottom of this. But, of course, while they ramp that up, all of the mass media, you never see this appear again, that, oh, well, actually the U.S. funded the development of a coronavirus in the lab. That's been completely censored now. So that implies that there's a uniform agreement at the top that it's okay to point the finger at China and ramp up anti-China militarism while completely censoring the fact that, well, it was actually the United States that funded some of this work in the Wuhan lab. So it indicates to me this high degree of coordinated censorship at the top that's affiliated with foreign policy thrusts that are being made at the moment.
I agree with you. And then we look at that, and we also add in the Crimson Contagion and the Event 201 that preceded this release. And I mean, I think you know, it points back at us. But who knows? Thanks, man.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Richard. Next question is from Nita Renfrew. Nita, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Hello. One thing, you know, it's like that I find very convincing is Luc Montagnier, who won the Nobel Prize for his work on the HIV virus. He came out and he said that it was definitely engineered and that, you know, an HIV segment was inserted into it. And he speculated that maybe they were trying to create an HIV vaccine, of course. But anyway, he said it was definitely engineered. Now, another thing, it's like the numbers are really inflated. And, you know, I live in New York City, and I really have a lot of questions about what's going on here. I mean, it's like I've seen reports, you know, where they've asked all of the funeral directors about, you know, the bodies piling up. And they say that every single death certificate has coronavirus on it. And that, you know, they don't believe that all these people had coronavirus because a lot of people were, you know, died at home or something and were never tested and they were just brought there and so on. And you know, the truth of the matter is, and, you know, I talk to people like superintendents and so on because they sort of know in the underground what's happening in New York. And there are questions about what's in a lot of those body bags that get buried in Potter's Grave and so on. And, you know, like there were these four trucks that said that the bodies in them were decomposing and there was a stench. And, you know, this one superintendent pointed out to me, he said, well, nobody was allowed to inspect them and see what was in those trucks. And, you know, it's like, and as to how, you know, the thing about elders, I mean, it's like I'm an elder person, and what this is creating, this whole thing about how we're, you know, more at risk and everything is creating a real sort of discrimination against us. You know, it's like people are talking about not allowing us to go back to work. I won't be able to pay my rent if I can't. Not allowing us into restaurants and things like this. This is just sort of what they're talking about doing, you know, putting the young people back to work and not the older people. Well, that's discrimination. It's older people with comorbidities and so on. I have a student of mine who did her internship out at Elmhurst Hospital, and at the time that there was all of this, you know, hoopla about all of the bodies there and all of the people dying there and everything, she said there wasn't one single person over 50. They were all under 50. you know, and in intensive care. And, you know, and then the other thing is that apparently the ventilators killed a lot of people. So, you know, it's like this is, and you know, and then I know older people who've been tested like they have the antibodies for coronavirus. I mean, I have one friend who has a lot of complications and so on, and she's in her 80s, and she didn't even know she had it. She said she had a headache for a couple of days. And, you know, but she tests positive with the antibodies. So I'm not so sure that, you know, that we can, you know, that we can classify all of these different things and say, well, it's older people and this and that and the other. I mean, it's like older people in the nursing homes here, that, you know, Cuomo ordered all of the older people with coronavirus back into the nursing homes. And then, you know, they don't count as having died in the nursing home somebody who was taken to the hospital a few hours before they die. So there's just a lot of, you know, a lot of stuff going on. I don't really think the coronavirus is as serious an infection as they have hyped it up to be, and that's what a lot of doctors are saying. They're saying it's just a bad flu type thing, you know, in the seriousness.
Yep, I think it is a little different. It's actually it's a virus that is causing some different complications than just the flu.
No, I'm not saying it's a flu. It's a flu, like in the sense that you know, it looks like the flu.
That's right, the numbers.
It's the blood and everything, which is why the ventilators are killing people. But
hey, I support your right to go out in the public as often as you want. You know, I think if you're an older person and you want to get out there and boogeyman, go get it. That's where I'm at. And
well, that's what I
do
every day.
Fun,
you know,
go out. You know,
and I don't know how many people I may have killed.
We're right? We should be able to do what we want to do in that sense.
Exactly.
So, right. Yeah. No, I agree with you.
Well, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Rita. Yeah. Next is Bonnie Faulkner. Bonnie, go ahead.
Yes, Alexander. Thank you. This is Bonnie
Hi,
Faulkner.
Bonnie.
Hi. I was wondering if you could describe in detail the virus. You said something about PRAA, and I couldn't catch that. It's something about enzymes. Could you describe the virus?
My understanding of it, I mean, it's a beta coronavirus. They break them down into different classes. I think this one is, I can't recall which one, but at any rate, it's like a spherical shaped capsid, you know, envelope. It's got spikes all over the outside of it. The spikes have what's called a receptor binding domain out at the tip of them. About halfway down the spike is where this amino acid insert, which consists of four amino acids, proline, I can't remember what the other ones are. The R and the A and the A are three other ones. They're in the sequence. The insertion of these amino acids has changed the overall shape of the spike just a little bit, but enough that it's conferred different functionality. So a lot of times what will happen with viruses, the way they get into a cell is the receptor binding domain connects with a receptor on a host cell. And then once that happens, usually what's called a protease or something in the organism's intercellular fluid will come along and will cleave the spike, meaning they will separate the spike into two components. And when that happens, it's basically thermodynamics. There's the virus will tend to want to move closer to the host cell. It's not like the virus has a brain or anything. It's chemicals. But it moves closer to the host cell, and when it does that, the two envelopes merge. The two cell membranes, the cell membrane and the virus membrane, merge. And when that happens, then the inner guts, if you will, of the virus are able to enter the host organism's cell. And all that RNA, it's just a genetic code, when it gets into the host cell, basically starts being processed by the host ribosomes and starts producing proteins into the intracellular fluid. And when all those proteins are produced in mass, they just tend to assimilate they package themselves together. And again, it's all electrochemistry. It's all, you know, preferential binding sites and things like that. But they tend to assemble themselves into these spherical shapes with spikes all on the outside of them. And then those get moved to the outside of the cell and kicked out into the intercellular space to go infect another cell. So that's how the virus replicates. So what differentiates these coronaviruses are the receptor binding domains on the spike. And depending on how the receptor binding domain is shaped, meaning what amino acids are there, they are able to kind of access different hosts. So, you know, just to simplify things, one spike might be really good at getting into a dog cell, and another might be really good at getting into a cat cell, and a third might be good at reptile cells, you know, and but you would have to have some structural changes to allow them to, say, get into a human cell. Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah, but now also, if this has been genetically modified,
what do we
hear about HIV inserts and this insert? Are you looking at inserts into this thing?
Right. So PRAA, that was what they said was an HIV insert. You know, those four amino acids, they're found in a lot of different things. It doesn't necessarily have to have come from HIV per se, but it is seen in HIV. You know, and it may have been noticed that it worked very well in HIV to accomplish a certain thing. So, you know, if you think of it like music, if you know a certain note goes really well with a certain chord, you might play it. And if you see that one virus has a certain chord, you know that if you add a particular note, it's going to make a certain sound. And that, you know, they may have seen this, if they could add this thing to this spike, it would have a certain effect. And, you know, I don't know if they took it straight out of HIV or not, but it's got a feature that accomplishes the same thing, which is what's called furin cleavage. There's an enzyme which can cleave the spike, which means it makes it easier for it to get into human cells. The net effect is that it makes it easier to get into humans.
And could I ask you one quick question? I know I don't want to take up too much time here, but there's been talk about ARB and ACE inhibitors. Like, for instance, there's two different kinds of blood pressure medicine. One is bad for this coronavirus, which I think is the ACE, and then the ARB is okay. Now, they had to take people off of the ACE inhibitor. It's for blood pressure and other things. Can you explain why that is affected by this virus? Do you know about that?
So I don't want to get into anything that might be construed as medical advice, but this virus is accessing the ACE2 receptor on cells, and angiotensin 2 it ties back to our blood pressure. You know, it helps to regulate blood pressure, and there are some theories out there that say that if the ACE2 receptors are compromised by this virus, then angiotensin 2 is rising, which has a cascading effect of causing endothelial damage and thrombosis and some other blood pressure changes and stuff. But I'm sorry, Bunny, I can't really talk about whether one medicine would be good or bad or indifferent. I hope you understand.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I appreciate your presentation.
Yeah, thanks, Bunny.
Thanks, Bonnie. And our last question comes from Malcolm Arnold. Malcolm, go ahead.
Yes. I joined the call late, so I apologize if I've asked something that's already been asked or is not in your realm of area. I'm kind of curious as to if you have any perspectives on what is being done with this with regards to operations in the future, or sub-operations, where they're using this as a cover story, because if the numbers don't match up, right, as far as how many people are dying, and that the reaction, if you look at the numbers that are actually passing away from this versus what's really happening, then that indicates that there might be something else going on, or that they're preparing this and they're using this as a first stage for something later on. And I'm just kind of curious if you have any insights into the total political economy of special operations of how this might be used or is being used.
Okay, so my gut instinct when this thing first happened, you know, back in February or whatnot, I said to my wife, I said, they're going to use this to take the elections. My sense was that a second wave is going to come, whatever that looks like. I don't know if it's going to be a different strain that's going to be more problematic, or if there's just going to be more cases, or I don't know what it's going to look like. But my fear has been that they're going to basically say we have to cancel our normal election process, and we're going to have to do some kind of online voting, and that they're going to ensure that the voting is going to be safe and secure and all the rest of it, but it's going to be a black box algorithm that they're going to control the outcome of, and they're probably going to have our elections from here on out. That's my concern. Operational, I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing as much as you are, you know, but that's my guess, is that a second wave is going to come in the fall. You know, they're going to use it to seize our electorate. And then from there, they're probably going to roll out a vaccine or some sort of solution, which was likely developed a long time ago. You know, like the other, but whoever had asked, you know, I think the vaccine's probably already been made before they released this thing, you know. You'd want to have an antidote before you use the weapon. So, I think the numbers aren't as bad as maybe they thought, but I also keep in mind that, you know, America really did respond, when asked. We all basically did what we were told. You know, we did isolate, we did stay home from work, we did wear masks, we did socially distance, and I think that did have a positive effect in lowering the number of cases. I mean, in a sense, I think this is a good thing. I don't know. I don't know what's going to come in the fall. I don't know if we're going to have a different version or a worse version, but I'm personally preparing for a worse version. I think that's what's probably coming.
So a question as far as taking the elections, that's dealing with basically the United States. But if you look at how the world has responded to this,
yeah,
the entire world has shut down. So, you know, except for maybe Sweden, but that's still their universities are closed down, and their schools from 16 to 18 are closed down. Everything below that is not closed down. So to me, this looks like this is some type of worldwide operation, coordination amongst governments across the world.
I agree with you.
Very coordinated. And so the stealing the United States elections, while that might be one operation, a sub-operation, you look at MKUltra, there's, 162 sub-operations. So you can have multiple operations going on, but I don't think that would be the big operation. I'm looking at what do you think are the big operations?
I mean, I think that's a pretty big one. I mean, if you control the outcome of every state and federal election, you know, in the United States, which is probably, you know, arguably at least the first or second strongest nation in the country, that's a pretty big operation. You know, other things, they've talked about making sure that RFID is placed in the vaccines so that they can catalog who's received what dose and when. So that might be something that they're gunning for. You know, I've heard people talk about a controlled demolition of the economy. I think that's probably valid, too. You know, a lot of people have profited greatly from this thing, if you could see it coming, consolidation of control. You know, if you're behind the wheel of this thing and you're tearing through, then you're gonna benefit. So I don't know, but I'd love to hear your thoughts, too, on what other things, you know, you might see. If you want to add to our email correspondence or whatnot, that'd be cool.
All right. Thank you very much, Malcolm, for that question.
Thank you.
And Xander, thank you so much for all of your work tonight in presenting and your research. I really appreciate that.
Thanks, Joe.
Okay. And we're going to move on because of the time to our second speaker tonight. And that will be Tom Wilkutz. He's a colleague here in Connecticut of mine and 9/11 researcher. And Craig is going to introduce him. Craig? Craig with us? Yes, Craig.
Sorry, I had to unmute myself, which...
Okay.
It wasn't good. Yeah. All right. Yes, Tom Wilcutz will be dissecting the scientific paper published in Nature that was widely used by the media to claim that the conspiracy theory that COVID-19 was made in a laboratory and or is a bioweapon has been debunked. Tom has a degree in biophysics from Rice University and is the principal member of the law firm Wilcutz and Habib in Hartford, Connecticut. As a trial attorney, Tom has extensive experience handling product liability cases where product manufacturers commonly employ scientific hired gun experts to obscure the truth about the virus, about the dangers of a particular product. It is Tom's opinion that such tactics were employed, I'm dealing with a very wide thing, I have to keep scrolling across, were employed in support of the media campaign to discredit any questioning that the COVID-19 virus evolved naturally from an animal species as opposed to it being developed in a laboratory. So I will hand it over to Tom then.
Okay, Tom, before you start, I'm just going to put us into lecture mode, and I'm going to have to unmute you for a moment. So just hang on for a second, please. Okay, Tom. Okay,
so,
you're unmuted, Tom. Yeah.
Good to go. Okay. So thanks for that introduction. You saved me some time covering a few things. And let me say I enjoyed Xander's presentation. There's little I would disagree with. There are a few nuances that maybe we'll touch upon. But in any case, I was just following this like most people, picking it up and the news coverage. But I have a group of friends online who are pretty diverse, meaning, there's a share of Republican types and Democrat types. This is not a red pill group. And so anyway, one of them, so they were debating the whole COVID thing. And as you might have seen, there the right-leaning media would tend to be suspicious of the mainstream views on this, and particularly because they were, happy to blame China for the virus and so forth. So in any case, and there was suspicion that it could have, come from a Chinese lab and it could have been a bioweapon. And so when this Nature article came out in mid-March, one of my friends sent it to me and says, ha, so, that whole conspiracy theory has been debunked. And that was very interesting to me because I hadn't taken a position yet, but the idea that you would be able to prove a negative that this wasn't created in a lab immediately perked my interest. So I looked at the news reports, and then I found the article itself and looked at it. And in my experience in handling product litigation, so manufacturers will hire, some of the best experts, that you can find in a particular field. And if they're on the wrong side of a scientific issue, then, the best thing for them to do is just to create complexity and confusion that's beyond the grasp of your ordinary person, and these cases are ultimately decided by jury, so that would be the goal. And this famously happened in the tobacco litigation, and in the product liability field, these tobacco scientists defenders became quite famous, and I had to deal with one myself. So I'm accustomed to taking a report that is really, put together by a high-level expert that is designed to basically obscure the truth. And when I read this Nature article, yes, that is exactly what it was. And the funny thing about, the whole notion that this article had proven anything, immediately reading it, that obviously wasn't true. The article put forward like three evidentiary claims, and everything in the article was couched in terms of what is probable and what they believe was likely to be true and so forth. Well, that's not a scientific proof. That's a position based on what limited evidence you have. So anyway, I told the friend who brought this to my attention, he's a bright guy, he's a former assistant U.S. attorney, and I told him, look, there's no proof in this article. There's nothing even close to it. But the funny thing about the article is that in one breath, it had what I would call doublespeak. So on the one hand, when it would look at the evidence, it would address the evidence honestly to the extent that it wasn't claiming to prove something that it couldn't, which would just make it look silly to anyone with science, you know, being able to read it critically from a scientific standpoint. But then it would also include these talking points, which were very aggressive in saying, well, this is implausible and so forth. So anyway, the bottom line is this article, in my view, was written specifically to give talking points to the media. But before I reached that conclusion, in my dispute with my friend, I said, you know, when I said there's no proof in this piece, and he, you know, wouldn't buy that from me, I said, well, let's ask the author of the article. So the way this is formatted online, you can send an email to the lead author, which is what I did. And I was very respectful and simply I repeated to him what they said in terms of their evaluation of the evidence, and it was all, again, couched in probable, most likely, and so forth. I said, you know, here's what I'm reading in terms of your evidence and claims, and I just, you know, I have a little dispute with my friend. I'd like you to clarify that you're not claiming to have proved anything here. And in any case, he didn't reply, which I wasn't surprised because the questions I put to him, there weren't any good answers. So in any case, I have a regular correspondence, email correspondence with Kevin Barrett, and I sent some of this to him. And then he got back to me and asked me to speak on it on his program, which then caused me to start researching this in much more depth. And it's got to the point where I'm almost complete with an article which I'm going to look to get published. But in any case, as I started going through this, I was able to tell that, you know, how this was all a reactive response to what was arising in the media. And as most of you are aware, that if there is a message out there that the ruling authorities don't want discussed, the best thing to do, if you can, is ignore it. And so that's how this first unfolded. There were most of the ideas about COVID being a bioweapon created in the lab. A lot of that came from foreign countries. But so the first major thing I encountered in the United States was the Washington Times wrote an article in January in which they raised the prospect that it could have been developed in the Wuhan biosafety level 4 lab, and then it could have been a Chinese bioweapon and so forth. There wasn't a lot of response to that article. You can ignore the Washington Times. But then on February 16th, Senator Tom Cotton, Republican Arkansas, went on the Fox Sunday News program, and he voiced the suspicion he had that this came from the Wuhan Chinese laboratory, and so that's when this thing first took off. So that's on February 16th. The following day, the mainstream media hit back hard, including an article from the New York Times, which said, you know, Kant is putting out a fringe theory that has been dismissed by scientists. Now, the interesting thing about that Times article is that it didn't cite any scientists or any authoritative organization for that proposition. It just made the bold claim. But in any case, It didn't take long to get that scientific support. A couple of days later, a letter was published in the medical journal, The Lancet, and it was just a quick letter thrown together, a group of scientists saying that this is this is outrageous that these claims are being made, and that it's just outrageous conspiracy theories and so forth. But there was, it wasn't a study or anything like that. It was just a group of scientists. Now, the interesting thing is there's a doctor, Meryl Nass, who also Kevin Barrett interviewed, and she's a bioweapons expert, and she wrote a short piece on that Lancet letter and basically noted that most of these guys are bioweapons scientists themselves, and so she really questioned their credibility. But in any case, that's where it sat. So you had Cotton, and then you had all the reaction in the media and this Lancet letter, and that seemed to control the narrative for a while. And then on March 12th, in the British newspaper Daily Express, Professor Francis Boyle, who probably a lot of you know as being a international law expert in the area of bioweapons, where he helped draft the international treaties on that, and including the law in the United States, which was supposed to make bioweapons development and research illegal. In any case, this newspaper article in Britain published his opinion, held him out as an expert, where he said he gave his opinion that he believed that this was a bioweapon. And what he relied upon was a scientific journal, a peer-reviewed, very high-quality piece that came out, which didn't take a position that he took, but basically some of the things that Zander has mentioned, including the spike protein on the virus that binds very efficiently with human cells, and then what he called the furin cleavage, which is the other important operation to enable this virus to infect humans, which has to cleave its way to enter the human cell. First it attaches, then it's able to enter. And this article that Professor Boyle relied upon referred to this cleavage, this furin cleavage ability of this virus as a gain of function characteristic of the virus. And Professor Boyle was very aware of what that meant. And gain of function doesn't necessarily mean it's developed in a lab, but there's the whole, gain of function technology that is employed. Zander explained some of that, and it came out in some of the questioning. So, in any case, now you had, before when you had a senator expressing a suspicion, he's a layperson, what does he know? Now you have a bioweapons expert who is relying on a respected peer-reviewed published article. So that was on March 12th. 5 days later, on March 17th, is when this Nature article gets published. Now, technically, this Nature article was submitted in the format of a letter to the editor, which meant it didn't have to be peer-reviewed. But it really is a article in terms of it. Let me say something about it. First off, there's no original research contained in the Nature article. It's just a survey of the available literature. And in surveying that literature, they use that to come up with their opinion. And it seemed clear to me that that article was fast-tracked to try to keep this story arising from Professor Boyle from getting any traction and snuffing it out at the inception, which the article succeeded in doing. And the really surprising thing to me when I noticed it was the Nature article was published on March 17th. On the very same day, there was a very in-depth Forbes article published that discusses the Nature article in depth. Now, there's simply no way that, I mean, they probably used Forbes because they had a writer there who does have a decent scientific background, but there's not any chance at all that that writer could have written the article he did and had it out there on the same day that the article, the paper he's referring to was published. So there had to be coordination there, which was interesting. And so to me, it was a clear, coordinated effort to immediately take control of the narrative, and the conclusion that was put in the Forbes article was something to the effect of science triumphs over conspiracy theories again, or something of that type of language. And then immediately, you know, every other mainstream outlet followed, and they all said, you know, this is now proven, and so forth. So anyway, the interesting thing about, so the article itself, the Nature article, which is the debunking article, the main claim they're putting out there is that the virus is not bioengineered. Now, what that means is you're basically using engineer. You're inserting molecules or whatnot and creating it in that fashion. That's different than gain of function technology. Now, gain of function, basically what gain of function is you're accelerating the evolutionary process. So the theory that they put out in this article was that the SARS-2 virus was closest to certain bat coronaviruses and this pangolin. It had the most commonality with the bat virus, but the pangolin, it had the commonality in terms of the spike protein that's needed to attach to the human cell. So the theory that has been put out is that somehow these two coronaviruses combined in nature and then then later evolved to be able to infect human cells. So, but the thing is that you can, to the extent that that is possible, you can accelerate in a laboratory. And the question about the Wuhan laboratory using gain-of-function research, that's exactly what that would mean. So you would take the bat coronavirus, maybe the pangolin coronavirus, and then you grow it on other tissues of other animals which are designed to make it evolve to the point where it can infect humans. And the key step in that, just for your knowledge, is that the ferret has a very strong relation with humans in terms of the ability to infect humans with the flu. So, and it's the same with the coronavirus. So if you can grow the virus in ferret tissue to the point where it is infectious with ferrets, it's going to be infectious with humans. So this basically, this gain-of-function technology is basically a way of speeding up the evolution, which these authors are saying they believe occurred. So there's nothing in the evidence that they discuss in their article that contradicts a gain-of-function pathway for creating this virus. Now, what's very interesting is at the very end of the article, they actually, in very obscure language, attempt to dismiss this gain-of-function. And I think I may just read from it because, for me, it's an example of what you find these hired experts doing. So what they say is, this is from the article, furthermore, a hypothetical generation of SARS-2 by cell culture or animal passage would have required prior isolation of a progenitor virus with very high genetic similarity, which has not been described. Subsequent generation of polyvalent cleavage site would have been required repeated passage in a cell culture, but such work has not previously been described. Now, what they're saying about it has not been described. That's a very cryptic way of saying you could do it this way, but since we didn't find it in the literature, they dismissed that gain-of-function possibility. Well, the thing is that when you're doing bioweapons research and development, you don't generally publish that in the literature. And Dr. Nass, again, made this point in her criticism of the article. She didn't actually focus on this gain-of-function language. But basically, that is their dismissing that, not because it's inconsistent with any of their evidence that they looked at, only that since it wasn't in the literature, it didn't happen. So this is the deception with which this article that has been used to dismiss this whole laboratory bioweapon point, that's the level of deception. Because, you know, gain-of-function technology is definitely a possibility here. And let me say a little bit more about that, because it's very interesting that gain-of-function gets no mention in the media. And the reason I point that out is this type of research was considered so dangerous that in 2014, because of all the complaints, the National Institute of Health had to shut down all funding on this type of research. And the funding for gain-of-function research was suspended for 3 years, from 2014 to 2017. And it was in 2014 that the NIH, through Fauci's NIAID, got funds over to the Wuhan laboratory. So when the gain-of-function funding was shut down in the United States is when they indirectly got money over to China, and they did that through an intermediary nonprofit called Equal Health Alliance. And in April, Trump actually shut down the funding to that, you know, and that caused a big brouhaha. And there's actually a 60 Minutes piece that was done on that, where 60 Minutes defended the funding and criticized Trump for shutting it down. I don't know. I wasn't following the time, Cheryl. How am I doing here? Well, I'll keep going. Let's see here. So there was a couple of questions that I wanted to comment on. One question had to do with flu vaccinations, and there is evidence on that, believe it or not. It was before the pandemic hit, the Army had conducted a study of the Army has a good way of studying a flu vaccine because all their personnel have to get it. And they conducted a study as to, you know, the efficacy of the vaccine and so forth. And one of the things they found was that the incidence of infection by coronaviruses went up with the flu vaccine. Now, that occurred when the only corona infections were common cold infections, because SARS and MERS were out of the picture, and this SARS-2 hadn't come along. But that so that's solid research that might be a risk factor. The other thing is I want to comment on the vaccine that they're talking about developing. As Xander said, this is an RNA vaccine. There has never been a successful production of an RNA vaccine ever. They have tried. They tried with SARS and the MERS, and I believe that's also the nature of the HIV and Ebola vaccine efforts, and they've all failed. The interesting thing about the failure with the SARS and the MERS is that the vaccine trial succeeded in generating antibodies, which they thought, oh, well, that's great. So it works. The problem is that after receiving the vaccine, the subjects would get a much worse infection with the SARS and the MERS than would occur without the vaccine. So, in fact, the vaccine, instead of protecting from the infection, triggered a much worse reaction to this infection. So that would be one of my concerns about them rushing a vaccine through here. You could actually, you know, if you're part of a ruling class or whatnot, and you give people a vaccine that has its effect, you can pretty much take out anyone you want, and then, you know, you could have either a benign version or whatnot, or, you know, take essentially a placebo for people who you don't want to harm, because this, you know, again, this virus doesn't hurt the vast majority of people. And the only way I think I would take a vaccine is if I was in a room with Bill Gates and I watched him take a dose from the same vial that they wanted to give to me. Otherwise, there's no way. I wouldn't want to do it anyway, but okay. So I think that probably covers it.
Tom, this is Cheryl. Sorry, earlier I was on mute and didn't realize that I was answering your question. To continue if you wanted to, but you didn't hear me, so sorry about that. Anyway,
well, that's okay.
Okay.
Actually, let me address a couple of quick theories that were thrown out. One question is the degree to which China, this could have come from China. So the only way I think that China was involved with this is if there was a coordinated effort with certain, you know, interests in the United States. And, I mean, that's possible. I mean, China has used this to shut, you know, take a much stronger control in Hong Kong. And I think there are certain interests. I mean, Gates has always had a decent relationship with China, the Rockefellers and so forth. I think there might be a split in this country between a nationalist who would be represented more by Trump, perhaps an industrialist, and then globalists who you know, would be more inclined to cooperate with China. So that's my comment on that. All right. Otherwise, Cheryl, I'm...
You're set? You're all set? Are we ready for questions? Okay, great. So let me put everyone into Q&A mode. So, Tom, while we're waiting for people to get in line for the questions, I had a question for you. Maybe you could, or a comment actually. Could you tell people a bit about your presentation you're going to be doing this Sunday at NOLA's Radio?
Sure. So, Kevin Barrett, in addition to interviewing a couple of us already, myself and Dr. Nast, has put together a program for this Sunday. Yes, it's advertised at NOLA's Radio, and so Dr. Nast. Professor Boyle, I think, is giving a pre-taped statement, and then Kevin and I can't remember his first name, and myself and then Barry Kissin. So there's going to be a discussion about COVID, and including questions and answers.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so we have a question here from Xander. Xander, go ahead.
Hey, Tom. Man, excellent work, and I completely agree with you on everything. The Nature article you're talking about, is that the one written by Anderson?
Yes, and I wrote a letter to him, and which he didn't reply to.
I wrote him the same. I wrote to him also. So we should compare notes. We might have fun working together a little bit on this. So anyways, man, thanks. Great work. And that's all I've got.
Well, thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Yep. And so I think it's due to the late hour, Tom, there aren't any other questions or comments. So I thank you for your great work. And I know you're writing an article. So when you get that published, we'll send it out to everybody on the list. And I know you said that's coming soon. So, well, thanks so much again. And we're now going to go into our announcements and things, and you're welcome to stay and listen. And thanks again. So let me get us out of Q&A. Okay, so everyone is unmuted, I think, right now, except for Peter and Craig. They must have self-muted, so if Peter or Craig, you want to unmute, you have to do that yourself. Any announcements or comments or anything that anyone want to share?
I had a comment about the audio from Tom. This is Greg, and it was fading in and out a lot, but I did catch it all.
Okay, so that's interesting because I heard it okay, but I know people were having trouble with my audio earlier too. Some were, some weren't. So I don't know what's happening here with that. But thank you for sharing that. Thank you. Anybody else have a announcement or a comment? Or
this is Xander. I purchased a microphone dedicated for these calls. So unfortunately, it's arriving tomorrow. But the next time I want to present, hopefully it'll be a little bit clearer for everybody.
Okay, hopefully that would help, yeah. Okay, and no announcements? I guess there's nothing happening because of the virus, right? So there's not much to announce, but there is that online one, the No Lies Radio one, coming up this Sunday. I think it's 2 o'clock Eastern, so there is that. All right, well,
I would like to say something. Do you
oh, yeah, go
me?
Ahead. Yeah.
Hi, this is Fern Tishman. I've been writing about 9/11 for years, from the time of 1991 when the coup began, and my letters to Ralph Nader, my letters with Clinton's impeachment proceedings, my communications about the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. I was forewarned three times about 9/11. And I would like to get it out to maybe Craig or you. I can't give you everything, but I have some documents that are okay. You know, I see this is about elections. You know, when 9/11 was a primary election day, 2000, I wrote to all the Supreme Court justices, our elections are not really by the people, and we don't have a primary election day this year because of the COVID, so I really believe that so I would like ways to get my communications out. I do get my communications out, but I would like to know how to give some of this stuff to Craig or you, so that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, let's, I don't know, Craig, maybe you want to respond to that. You have a website there. I don't know if you have a thought on that.
Well, I guess just that perhaps we should, you know, follow up directly apart from the call and, you know, sort of discuss that. I don't have any sort of, really thoughts at the moment, but just I'd like to sort of take it up with Fern.
Okay.
I email you, but I would like to give it to you in person. So that's what I usually do.
I'm up in Canada, so it might be a bit of a trip for you. Or for me.
New York.
Yeah, I'm in Montreal in Canada.
I didn't know that. Maybe someone is in New York that I can give this stuff to. So I usually go to school. They're closed, so whatever. Thank you.
Yeah, so Fern, I'm in Connecticut, so maybe we could talk offline and figure out something. I mean, I don't have any ideas about how to share it either, but let's talk. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks.
Any other thoughts, comments? We do need a secretary. If anyone would like to volunteer to do that at any point, that would really be great.
Cheryl, maybe I could just quickly refresh people's memory as to what that entails.
Yeah, that's okay.
It just basically involves doing the minutes once a month, and it's really not a difficult thing. Although you wouldn't know that by the fact that we didn't get them out this month, but. It's not difficult, and especially, you know, if you do it fairly soon after the meeting when everything's fresh, I would think it wouldn't even be, you know, barely an hour a month. So if anybody would like to try it, maybe even try it for, you know, 6 months or 4 months or something, just to see if it, you know, if it suits them, and it'd be great. So because I did it for 8 years, and I think I'm ready to move on. So
okay.
That's that.
Yeah, don't be shy about volunteering for that now. We could use it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other thoughts or comments?
Yeah, can I be heard?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Lynn in Iowa. I was going to give my email address and my phone number in case anybody just wanted to contact me.
Sounds great.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you ready? Everybody got a pencil or whatever?
Yeah.
My email is healingartsman. That's healingartsman at gmail.com. And my telephone number is 641-782-8367. I'm the only one here. It's my home phone, and I have an answer machine.
Great, thanks, Lynn. Appreciate that.
We'll put those in the minutes as well, since you've announced them. So that way, anybody that didn't have a chance to write it down will be able to see it there.
Good.
Great.
Great. Okay. Anybody else? All right. I guess that's it for the evening. And thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight. We'll see you next month on the 24th of June. If anyone has any ideas for speakers, please contact us. Appreciate that.
Thanks, Cheryl. Thanks, Greg. Very, very much.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you all.
Good night, guys.
Okay.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.